humans are incredibly resourceful, and they are all capable of performing miles beyond the boundaries that they normally put on themselves and that other people put on them. And that actually, if you can tap into that, if you can find what it is, you can, you know, you can just unleash something that is a competitive advantage beyond all others.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Private Equity Power Talks, Map of the Maze. I'm your producer, Richard Ayliffe. This is our first episode of season two, and we're delighted to introduce you to strategic people manager and chief of staff, Ellie Roma Lee. In this podcast, Ellie takes us through her journey at digital identity verification company Onfido, where she joined as employee number 12 in 2014 and ran the people team through to late 2020, when the business had a headcount of more than 400. Ellie describes her approach to talent, culture, and values within a business, and how creating a workforce of diverse thinkers with the opportunity to challenge, innovate, and progress leads to a culture of growth and constant improvement. Ellie also explains how leaders should present themselves and communicate with their employees in order to achieve a high level of engagement. Now, over to Sam and Ellie.
Ellie, lovely to see you. Thank you for joining me today for this episode of Map of the Maze.
Pleasure. Nice to see you too.
It'd be fantastic to hear from you, just employee number 14 in Onfido. And by the time you left last year, you were employee number 400 and something. So yeah, that must have been an incredible journey. It'd be great just to hear how you got involved with them, what it felt like at the start of your journey, and then when we can take it from there.
Yeah, sure. So I got involved with Onfido in 2014. I'd done another sort of, I guess, 2.5 year cycle with a startup called Hirespace. I'd ended up in a people brief by mistake, partly because I'd been a teacher prior to that and was kind of drawn to questions of developing people and performance, and partly because I'd done loads of hiring and managing and it just seemed to make sense. And so I was kind of on the lookout for a startup that looked to me to be immediately pre-Series A. So I wanted to go early, but I also wanted to experience the kind of hyper growth that comes with some VC investment. So I spoke to a few founders. I actually just found a job on, I think it was UK Startups, and it was called Office Manager. And it sort of basically said, do everything apart from build or sell the product. And I thought, sure, it's not an office manager, but I could do that. So I emailed over my CV, and true to startup life, got a call from Eamon, the COO and co-founder, at like 11:30 that night to say, amazing, let's talk. And, you know, I went to meet him and had a conversation with him, and then actually went for a meal with the other two founders as well. And, you know, it sort of became clear that this was going to be, I thought anyway, one of those rocket ships, just the kind of thing I was looking for in terms of growth. That the opportunity for somebody like me, who was kind of a business generalist, but with a particular leaning towards people questions, mm-hmm. was going to be off the charts, because basically there was no one else really doing that stuff. So as you say, I was actually employee number 12, very important 12. To get these things right. I can pip you by two more than 14. So I joined as employee number 12, and yeah, I led the people function for 7 years. Ultimately, I left just a couple of months ago. As you say, we're a little over 400. We had, you know, offices all around the world, two in the States, in Europe, one in India, and it was, you know, one of the most extraordinary experiences, probably the most extraordinary experience of my professional life. To try to address your question about what did it feel like, I mean, always on the edge of losing control, always like we were just about to be completely out of our depth. And I actually think that was one of the greatest gifts of it as an experience, that I kind of learned to live with that. I kind of learned to roll with it, to stop trying to answer all the questions and plan all the plans. And, you know, I think that sense of whack-a-mole is quite familiar to most senior leaders in these businesses. And I sort of just learned to let it go, to just see it all as noise and fury, and to be really clear-headed at any given point about what I thought was the thing to be focused on. And sometimes I was right and sometimes I wasn't. But yeah, actually, I think cultivating a greater sense of kind of easygoing with it, although I'm sure plenty of my colleagues at Onfido would say I was anything but easygoing as a personality. But yeah, was a huge part of the gift of it, I think.
Why did the founders come to the conclusion that they needed somebody to strategically think about people? Because I think a lot of our audience, they'll have some HR resource, but they won't have a chief people officer. They won't have a strategic thinker like you. So what led those founders to say, right, we need to go and find an Ellie now?
That's such a good question. And you're right. Like I consult with businesses now that are absolutely enormous and still don't seem to have really got going with that thinking. I think what was distinctive about Ayman, Hussein and Rahul and part of what drew me to them as founders was they had two really clear motives for founding Onfido. One was a real world problem that they'd all lived, which was this problem of proving who you are online. And the other was this really clear sense of frustration from three quite young guys that most businesses were not run in a way that was conducive to humans working well. They had this really clear sense that they could just do better as an employer and that there was something that a lot of businesses were missing that they could get under the skin of. And I think that that also pincered with my very clear belief. You know, I mentioned that I was a secondary English teacher before I got into startup life. And, what I carried out of teaching was a sense that humans are incredibly resourceful and they are all capable of performing miles beyond the boundaries that they normally put on themselves and that other people put on them. And that actually, if you can tap into that, if you can find what it is that is, you know, holding that kid back from their C at GCSE English or holding that marketing manager back from creating that incredible campaign or whatever it is, you can, you know, you can just unleash something that is a competitive advantage beyond all others. And again, I remember saying to you the first time we met, you know, the reason startups do this, I think, particularly, is it's the only advantage they have is their people.
Yeah.
You know, when we were 14 of us going up against Equifax or whoever it was, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous sense of, you know, David and Goliath. But what we had was 14 great brains. And God, did we need to make the most of them. So I think it was, you know, it was those two things. One, that it was always part of what mattered to those three founders. And two, that we shared this belief that actually it was going to be the key to our success, getting those humans on board, getting them in a mindset where they could think really expansively and really freely, and then go pursue those goals, you know, hell for leather. That was what was going to get us there.
So how did it develop then? Just what were, if you can, what were those chapters of, okay, you know, stage one was this, two was this, three was this, by the time I left, it looked like this.
I mean, I can try. I think, as you say, you sort of, you're too busy flying the plane when you're in it. But
yeah,
in hindsight, I can probably start to answer that. So I think to begin with, as I've said, I did all of it. I brought in support on the HR ops and recruitment sides pretty quickly and grew the recruitment team out first and fastest because we were growing so fast. In terms of how HR then developed, we brought in initially a kind of HR managers and HR ops specialists, and then we brought in and business partners. Culture was always my kind of personal front and center responsibility. And yeah, so I guess talent first, talent meaning recruitment, recruitment first, then HR ops, and then probably the business partnering with those other elements, kind of always part of my remit as well, the comms and the culture. And, you know, frankly, scaling up that team to meet business requirements, I think it was a constant source of, let's say, debate within my team that my natural tendency was to run the team slightly behind the demand, i.e. I would wait until I was absolutely sure that it was completely broken and then I would add another person, because it's the background that I come from and that's how I'm used to managing resource. I think my team would argue to you that sometimes that was short-sighted and sometimes I'd have done better to get slightly ahead of it. But, you know, obviously we had rules of thumb around how many recruiters we needed to bring in X jobs in Y specialties. And the same with our business partners and our our ops functions.
How did you hire 50 to 100 people a year?
With extreme difficulty.
But you probably established it, you know, a real process to do that, just in terms of sourcing candidates. You must have had a process for sourcing candidates. You must have been thinking about, how do we assess those candidates? How do we assess them against what we want culturally and in terms of skills and experiences?
It definitely gets slick. I think it's one of those skill sets that's tested in the fire. Let's start with, how do we find our candidates? To begin with, referral. The vast majority of people that we brought on were either, you know, friends or classmates or previous colleagues of our existing team. And I think there's a great deal to be said for that. There's also a massive caveat, though, which most people miss, which is around diversity. We, as a team of sort of 25, probably even 50, we were terribly proud of ourselves diversity-wise, because from a kind of racial point of view, we were incredibly diverse. You know, it helps to have an Iraqi and an Iranian co-founder kind of there and setting things off. And, you know, we brought developers over from Egypt, and it was kind of very diverse in terms of nationality. But, you know, right up until 50, kind of the vast majority of us were Oxbridge educated. And there was this moment where you thought, oh, we're just not as clever as we think we are on this topic.
That's really interesting, because if you were referral orientated in terms of the hiring, in terms of sourcing, it's like, right? You're just, it's a bit of a herd.
Yeah, it totally is. And I do think it's the caveat that most people miss when they're talking about that referral funnel. Mm. Is that you do end up hiring, you know, a team of people who have very similar, whatever it is, educational background or professional background. But it is very easy to fall into groupthink without even realizing that that's what was going on. So upon that realization, we actually started doing a lot of headhunting. And that's why we were scaling that recruitment team particularly hard. And we had some absolutely brilliant headhunters on the team. And, you know, again, we were really targeted about who we wanted. We would create, you know, shortlists of, we want one of these five people, and we'd go get them. And I think a lot of the kind of team from the early days spent our time really networking. You know, we were often out at breakfast events or forums or, you know, whatever it was, just trying to meet other people who were in businesses a bit like ours, scaling a bit like ours. Understanding, frankly, who their superstars were, who the people who were kind of getting the airtime, and we would really pursue them. There's a fantastic woman on Vido now who's doing, you know, wonderful work for them. I bought her lunch every year for 5 years, probably, until one day I got her. So, you know, sometimes it's about playing the long game as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly kind of that was another important part of our strategy for finding candidates. Of course, we always, you know, we always advertised and we always had open funnels. Generally speaking, we found them fairly low hit rate. You know, we would have to screen an awful lot of inbound applications in order to find anything that looked particularly like it was going to work. But every so often we did. But then you get into ROI debates as a team when you're, you know, needing to get as much through the pipe as we were. And I'd say the final part of all of this is, you know, that we cultivated some relationships with some really great headhunters. You know, this was often true when we were going into a new geography. So, you know, we set up a sales office in New York and none of us had any network in New York and we never worked, they didn't know what we're doing. So, you know, we found a specialist headhunter on the ground who'd worked with some of our sales leaders before, and off we went with them. In London, I'm lucky enough that I was mentored by Claire Johnson, who's the Upgroup CEO for many years. Mm-hmm. So I sort of always had her as a sounding board, and, you know, they helped us out with a few key hires. And I think it's just all about, you know, finding, when it comes to headhunters, finding, you know, the people who seem to speak your language, building deep relationships with them over many years, so that when you come to be making those critical hires with them, they kind of know the DNA of the business without, you know, you needing to try and explain it in a 40-minute meeting.
Mm-hmm. And what about the processes you put in place for developing talent internally? Obviously, you know, you're on a journey as a business. You would have been selling that journey and that vision to future employees. And what about the internal employees? How did you look to develop them so they could help you scale?
Yeah. And again, that is a story which has chapters because very different depending on which stage of growth we were at. Early days, honestly, it was almost impossible not to develop because everything was moving so fast that there were always, you know, any one point there were 50 jobs in the office that needed doing. And if you wanted to learn something new, you need only put your hand up. It's fine. Yep, lovely. It's yours. You want to run a team? Lovely. Here it is. Catch.
Want some more responsibility? Here you are.
Exactly. Brilliant. You want to do some finance? Great. Here you go. That, you know, in some ways was very easy. Although, again, it's got to be said, it works for certain personalities, and for other personalities, that is a totally overwhelming experience. And that's part of where your qualification is so important when you're hiring, is finding, you know, the right people for the right moment.
Yeah.
As much as anything else. So yeah, early days, it was kind of just built into the DNA, impossible to avoid, frankly. But as we started to really scale, again, I think this is where my kind of own skill set and my background as a teacher really started to come to the fore. We built a lot of scaffolding really early on. We built job tracks and levels within them. And we tried to be really, really descriptive around how people would behave when they were at those different levels. And then we were able to build out all of our, you know, all of our talent support around those, so that we were being really clear with people what they needed to do in order to progress. We've always believed in you know, the kind of one-to-one interventions as well. So Onfido supported coaching for a lot of people, me included, and I'm now coaching some Onfidoers as an external coach, which is brilliant. I think connected to that, we've had Sanctus in place for a very long time as a benefit, which the way Sanctus explain themselves is it's coaching for mental wellness. So rather than seeing, you know, therapy as something that you have when you're mentally ill, this is about building resilience and coaching for fitness. So I think it's just all about, you know, a framework that sure becomes more formal and repeatable as you get bigger, just because it's got to be easier to manage at a higher scale. But basically it's about, you know, putting your money where your mouth is on these topics. You can't be a business that talks about people's development and learning unless you're prepared to really invest in it. And then within that, creating enough scope and freedom that people can pursue the things that they love.
So you mentioned culture earlier. I know it's you know, one of your great passions.
It is.
But when did you start really you working on, right, let's start defining Onfido's culture and let's put some structure and process around this so we can engage everybody with the idea?
And now some thoughts from PE-backed CEOs on their Pep Talks membership experience.
It's been absolutely invaluable for me. Throw away your preconceptions about this type of event, because I had all of those.
The dinners are amazing, the speakers are extraordinary, but probably the most useful thing is actually talking to other people.
It's been a tremendous way of me learning rapidly, becoming a more experienced and valuable CEO. It's good for me and it's therefore good for the business as well.
That network is incredibly valuable to me now, not just as a support network, but potentially a business network as well.
The quality of the individuals, the intimacy of the events has just made it very, very easy to learn an awful lot.
It's been genuinely, you know, transformative. It's absolutely palpably helped me get better at my job.
If you would like more information on Pep Talks membership, then email us at info@pep-talks.co.uk.
Again, it's such an interesting topic because I think there is always this kind of tussle, frankly, between what is your culture as a result of the humans that you have in the room versus how you want to direct that and be intentional about it and craft it into something as a result of the way that you talk about it and the way that you, you know, support and encourage and reward it via various mechanisms. And I think you sort of have to start off with that paradox in mind, the one that says it's both of these things simultaneously, and I've got to live with that. Not going to be fully a product of, you know, who the CEO is. It's not going to be fully a product of this framework I write. There's always going to be this movement up and down that continuum, and I need to build into the way I think about it sort of enough space for that. But to answer your question directly, we started pretty early on. So I joined Onfido in October 2014. I had written the formal values framework by the following summer, so by summer 2015. That was driven by the pace of our hiring. Again, very early doors. You know, our culture fit interview was we'd interview somebody with their sort of technical skills, and then we'd get them to stay for lunch with the whole team, and they'd wander out, and I'd say to the, you know, 18, 20, 25 people assembled, like, what do you think? Is that going to work? Which again, by the way, is an enormous flag now looking back, because to my point about referral, asking any question as baggy as that is an absolute disaster for your diversity initiatives. That's saying, is that person like us or not?
Yeah.
So we decided to do the work kind of, I guess, Q2 2015, because we were now hiring quickly and we needed something that was just more repeatable, more reliable, and could be done faster. So that was the sort of initial driver for it. But actually, you know, looking back, I think it's the thing I'm personally proudest of is the work on culture, and specifically the values framework at Onfido. Because, you know, I was thinking about that Peter Drucker quote the other day, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, it could not be more true of my time at Onfido. Once you find a way to be really intentional about what you want people to do when you don't give them any instructions, which I think is a great test of culture, then it's honestly, you know, it's life or death. It's the difference between building a fantastically successful, quickly scaling, positive, happy business and something that is an absolute disaster is that you find a way to bring together people who share, you know, a common sense of the way they want to behave, a common sense of what they understand performance to involve, and a common set of kind of motives and values and responsibility, I guess, for getting there. And it trumps everything else. If you get that right, you win.
Yeah. It sounds in theory easy to do, but I know it's so difficult to get right in practice. I mean, what, tell us about the values that you identified, and tell us how you managed to sort of shape them and plug them into the business.
Yeah, sure. Looking back, I wouldn't call them values. I wish we'd called them behaviours, because I think values sounds much baggier and much more kind of personal and quasi-political. And that's not what we were ever talking about. We're talking about what people do in order to be successful. The first tale I would tell, and the first thing that we got right by luck, frankly, was that those things, they already exist in your organisation. So all of us, if you went to, you know, 10, 50, 100 members of your team and said, who's the most impactful person in this business? They'll tell you who that is. And if you then say, what is it about them? What is it about how they do their job? How do they create this impact? Again, the organization will be able to tell you. And therefore, what becomes absolutely critical is that leaders spend time and effort and real respectful attention hearing that answer that already exists. Because if you go out to try to market something that is different to what everybody already knows to be true, then you're already sunk. You've already got yourself up to a horrible, horrible start. So mostly we spent time asking them questions exactly like that. Like, literally in this room, point to the person that's most impactful and tell us about them. What do they do? Let's imagine that you're hiring somebody for your team. What's on your long list of things you'd like to have? And what's your short list of five never compromise? And very quickly, you start to see patterns emerge. So yeah, lesson one, spend a lot of time and deep investment actually hearing your employees, because they already know the answer. Lesson two, once you have this thing declared, understand that the way employees come to understand the importance of it is completely via how you behave. There are lots of ways of trying to illustrate that to founders, but I think the most honest one is your behaviours, your culture, is who you hire, who you fire, and who you promote. Based on those decisions, your employee base will deduce everything about what you value in people.
Yeah, just recognize behaviors, look for the behaviors, hire those behaviors, promote those behaviors.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and live by them. So, you know, again, I said the test I normally confront founders with is it's who you hire, who you promote, and who you fire. And, you know, because of that, it means it's got to live in all of your systems. So, yes, you're right. It's there in your interview questions and your assessment that you do pre-hire. It should be there in, you know, all of your HR systems. So pass or fail on promotion should consider cultural alignment. All of our performance reviews, you know, you've got a score for your kind of technical performance and your outputs, but also a score for your cultural behavior. It was there in our pay framework. It was there in our promotions framework. It was there absolutely everywhere it could be because, you know, it mattered. Why wouldn't you put it there?
I mean, my next question was going to be, how could you measure the return on investment in that work in developing culture? And I suppose you may have already just partially answered.
With extreme difficulty. Well, and also it's sort of one of those things where you're like, you know, if you take the oxygen away, what will happen? Well, probably everyone will die, but I can't completely guarantee it until I try. You know, I think it is somewhat nebulous, but there are lines of sight into it. I would certainly argue that a business's overall performance is a line of sight into the success or failure of its culture. Another is, frankly, your reputation. So, you know, often, you know, I went through many, many rounds of funding with Onfido, and we often got feedback from VCs that was one of the things that had closed the deal for them, was they just saw something special in the way that we were building the culture and the way that our employees talked about it. Again, you heard it out on the market when you were trying to hire. You know, most people, when they joined our business, we would always get them to do a sort of stand-up at whole company breakfast and say why they joined Onfido. And 95 times out of 100, they'd say something to do with the culture. Mm. So, you know, I think you do get lines of sight. But I think, you know, that the honest answer is you can feel it. You know, you walk into a business and you can feel whether it is a place that is basically energetic and engaged and performing, or whether it's a place where there's a problem. And if you can't feel it straight away, you need only ask 4 or 5 people. Yeah. It's sort of back to my point about how do you come up with a values framework. Your business will tell you. Yeah. Your business will tell you whether it's a culture that's working. If your business won't tell you as the CEO, well, that's an interesting problem that bears some investigation, but there are still other ways around it.
Just going back to a point you made earlier about diversity. So, you know, you were growing internationally. As you said, you had great ethnic and social diversity, I'm sure, because of the international locations. What did you do to change your approach to hiring when you recognized that you might have had a diversity issue? How did you make it change happen there?
The biggest answer to that was changing how we sourced people. So that's when we moved away from the kind of referral as God policy, because we realized that it was giving us some issues. I think we always had baked into our recruitment a sort of fiercely meritocratic manner of measuring people. So again, you know, frankly, I used all of my teacher training and we literally built competency frameworks that would not only say what we were looking for, but they would say how people would behave if they were performing at different levels. And we would then train pairs of interview partners and get them to, you know, record in the form of notes, record their evidence essentially for asserting that somebody was performing at a particular level. And so we worked really, really hard on all that kind of stuff, which I think is important. I do think it's important. You know, for instance, we would never let anything ride that was, you know, an interviewer saying veto because I didn't like the guy or made me feel funny or any of that nonsense that you still do see all about the place. But again, if I'm honest, I feel like I was extremely naive at the beginning of this whole journey. And I think I, A, had an overpronounced sense of myself as a kind of representative of a minority, basically because I was one of two women on the team for, I don't know, a long time. I was always in a minority gender-wise, and that, you know, continued right through to the end, although obviously got a lot better. So I think I had an overpronounced sense of that. And also, I really failed in my early career to understand how loaded was that concept of meritocracy. You know, the bar's not level. it's not actually a good way to set about the problem. And again, I think what I have learned and what I would argue about diversity is that it is fundamentally cultural again. It sort of doesn't start with your hiring. It starts with the extent to which people can be themselves at work. I was reading a really brilliant book the other day called More Time to Think by Nancy Klein. And she has this moment where she says, "We want you to be as you can possibly be." And I thought, well, if all businesses started with that, then we wouldn't have to be worrying about how we hire diverse candidates, would we? Because if that was the starting point, that we want you to be as you can possibly be, and we believe that having as great a range of yous in the room is going to help us make the best decision, then it would be just a natural and obvious part of how you bring brilliant performing humans into a team, is you would need to be looking for somebody who brings something slightly different. So, you know, again, I think next time I do this, and I do hope there'll be another really exciting cycle, I'll start out from day one thinking about what diversity really means, and also really challenging leaders on the extent to which they're going to live by it. You know, what's their view of a good meeting? Is it one where everybody agrees? Is it one where a team is really nicely aligned? Because I'd say that's probably a bit of an issue. You know, or are they really truly out there looking for the people who are going to disagree with them and tell them why? Yeah. You're going to be an absolute pains at the bum and challenge them all the time. Is that what they want? Because that's what we mean when we talk about diverse teams getting brilliant outcomes. That's what we mean. And again, Nancy Klein has this moment where she talks about, you know, a business at the moment being full of naked emperors who don't even know that they're naked. And I think that's so true. You know, it's such a hot topic. And, you know, everyone, all CEOs and all leaders are asked about it on everything they ever do. But, you know, most of us live in, you know, very, very small worlds where we're not really prepared to challenge our own views. You know, one of the most challenging questions I've ever been asked on this topic is, when was the last time you ceded your own interests to somebody else's because of a question of diversity? And you sort of think, oh, that's what it means. I see. That's a completely different thing to, do I think there should be a quota of women on the senior team?
Absolutely. Well, it's good food for thought. And I think it, you know, I think we feel the same way. It's a diversity of thought. That's what you're really looking for. But to get to a diversity of thought, you need a diversity of people and a diversity of background. And then when you have that diversity, you've got to be willing and able to be to harness it.
And, you know, of life experience, like I'm currently 8 months pregnant with my second child. Nothing changed my view on all of this as much as becoming a mother, because suddenly I was just like, there were just all these things that I had just never known to think about before this life experience. And had I not had it, I would be a fundamentally much less effective exec than I am right now. And, you know, fine, that's one spike of, you know, an infinite possible number, but bringing together, you know, a group of people who genuinely see the world differently, which means they're genuinely going to disagree a lot of the time, and they need to learn to do that respectfully and productively. That's really hard. We're sort of not taught to do that. We're taught to seek out people who are like us and who agree with us.
So my last question is, just takes us back to the beginning, because you told me your founders obviously had a problem they wanted to fix in terms of the service they Onfido provides, but then they wanted to create an environment where people worked in a better way. So did they manage to achieve that by the time you left? And what was the better way?
I would love to ask the three of them what they think about that. I think from my perspective, it was an incredible run. You know, I think we achieved more than I would ever have believed possible when I joined the business in 2014. And I feel very proud of the fact that we, you know, created jobs for hundreds of people, that supported, you know, in turns, big networks of families and communities to, you know, do what they wanted to do, but also in jobs that I know were fulfilling. So I could feel very good about all of that. I think it's also true to say that I've learned an enormous amount, and that I would like to do this again, and that I'll plough all of that forward into you know, into a sort of a new cycle and a new series of experiments. I think if they did find a way, it was probably that value that I keep coming back to. It was about having the humility to recognize that you'd probably never settled on the right answer, and baking that into all of your assumptions, that everything was challengeable, that you always wanted people to bring, you know, the full horsepower of their intellect to bear on a problem, and to have the courage to tell us if they thought we were wrong. I think that was probably, you know, the single most powerful thing that I learned from my cycle on Vido.
Well, Ellie, that's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. It's been good fun.
And we're looking forward to getting to know you more, you know, introduce you more to our members, hopefully in our physical format events. And if there are people out there that want to get in touch, then they can do that. If you just drop me an email and I can put you in touch with Ellie, and I'm sure you'd be happy to talk to them. Yeah. Ellie is now consulting, aren't you? We should probably say that.
Yes, I am.
You're going to apply these experiences to businesses as a consultant.
Absolutely right.
And we'd love to put people in touch with you if they want to do that.
Yeah, well, I would be delighted. And yeah, thank you, Sam. It's been fun to have a reminisce.
Yeah, it's been great. Really good to talk to you. Thank you very much. So, Richard, what did you make of that? What did you think of that podcast?
Yeah, really, really interesting podcast. I come from a family of teachers, and as I was listening to and editing the podcast, I could see things Ellie was saying popping up in things that I've heard my parents say before. I think it's quite an interesting position to be in, where your success is fully based on the success and well-being of the people around you. I think that's a good way to just approach culture. I mean, Ellie made quite a few points about how culture's sort of already there and ingrained. It's all about listening to your employees and what they already think. So that idea of being solely based on them when you create your culture, I think, can be quite powerful.
No, I agree. I thought another thing that was quite interesting was the problem that they had with diversity, which wasn't one that you would expect from a business like that, which had grown in multiple geographical locations. So they had a high degree of diversity in terms of culture and ethnicity, because of their global reach, but they still had an issue, and that issue was rooted in the fact that their recruitment processes, like all early stage businesses, like all of us, we depend on referrals. And by doing so and building your teams in that way, you are going to hire like for likes, aren't you? And there's a danger that you're going to fall then into groupthink. And I thought Ellie's insights around the need to go and hire talent that had the intellect, the experience, the capabilities they were looking for, but really had the ability to challenge them. And I think that's what's really behind diversity, isn't it? Accepting whatever form of diversity, accepting to be challenged in a very positive way, in the right way, but with somebody or a group of people who come from completely different backgrounds that have a completely different perspective, and that perspective really adding value into your business.
I guess a scenario you really have to be proactive in as well. I mean, in those early stages when they were onboarding people just from referrals, and as you say, there was sort of that element of groupthink, it must be so difficult to recognise that that's an issue. Just because obviously you're getting that feedback from all these people who are obviously really happy working in an environment with all these people they get along with because they're so similar. It's going to be very difficult to then identify that sort of issue where everyone's just patting each other on the back saying, what a great idea.
Yeah, and the momentum in the business is really strong, and everything's going in the sort of upward trajectory and direction. And actually, you know, you're all going with the flow. So I was surprised by that, and I thought the experience you brought was really interesting. And then the second piece that really struck me was around her building of the processes of culture within the business. And, you know, the consultants out there would put us all in a room and ask us to identify our values and put some nice, you know, words up on the wall. And, you know, actually that doesn't really work, does it? And I thought what Ellie did was sort of genius in the simplicity, in that she just went and asked. It was already there. You know, she just went and asked her organisation. She put people in a room and she'd say to them, Richard, you know, stand up and tell us who in this room is the best, you know, the highest performer in your mind, and tell us why. And what behaviours and characteristics do they display that make them successful? So she identified something that was already there.
Yeah, I think that's what was really impressive about Ellie's whole process is that element of it being quite self-sustaining. It's just like you recognise it in the business and then you just sort of push it along and help it grow. So I don't think there's really anything worse than if you were joining a business or you're partway into a business and someone comes up to you and says, by the way, this is our culture, this is how you should be acting.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed the conversation with Ellie. Thank you, Ellie, for participating and being involved. We wish you the best of luck with the arrival of your second child, and which is imminent, happening any minute now, I would have thought. And also, you know, we really look forward to working with you later in the year, perhaps in the autumn, and introducing you further to the community. Thank you.